dream is out there. Try to think of life as a big-ass Christmas tree. Then think of God as our collective father, who has made sure to put one gift under that tree for each of his children. Don't try to grab someone else's gift, no matter how shiny or cool it might look. You're not ever going to find lasting success that way. Keep on rooting around under that giant tree until you find the gift with your name on it. And if I catch you playing with someone else's gift, I'm going to let you know about it. I'm going to hit you with a demotivational speech because that's what you need. Sometimes I see people write online that I'm a dream killer or a pessimistic person. Those are just knee-jerk reactions. The fact is, I'm extremely optimistic. I have complete faith that as long as you follow your dream, you're going to find success. Principle 4. There are no losses, only lessons. You should give zero fucks about any perceived losses in life, as long as you learn something from them. Always look for the lesson in any situation you think didn't go your way. Understand that your plan isn't necessarily also God's plan for you. My friend Donnell Rollins, a.k.a. Ashy Larry from Chappelle's Show, once told me that you don't become a true star in radio until you've been fired 3 times. Well, by that measure, I must be doing pretty well, because I've been fired 4 times. Some of you are probably thinking, yes, but you deserved all those pink slips because of your foul-ass mouth. That might be the perception, but I've never actually been fired for anything I did on the air. There aren't any stories of me getting people to have sex in church like Opie and Anthony, or getting in trouble for making fun of tsunami victims like Miss Jones did, or threatening to put mayonnaise in the crack of a 4-year-old girl's butt and take a bite out of it, like Star threatened Envy's daughter. Nope, nothing like that. And as far as off-the-air behavior, I consider myself a model employee. Almost to a person, I know my colleagues have respected and enjoyed working with me. That's one of the reasons why when I look back at those firings, none of them felt devastating to me. There was never a moment when I felt like getting let go was a death sentence to my career. I always remained optimistic that I was going to bounce back because I subscribe to the concept that there are no losses in life, only lessons. When you get fired, instead of getting mad at your employer or getting down on yourself, the best thing you can do is say, thank you for the opportunity, and keep it moving. Then once you've given yourself a day or two to get past whatever emotions you might be feeling, take a calm, cool, and collected look at the reasons behind your termination. Even if you were told, like I often was, that your employer was simply going in another direction, something motivated that. Figure out what it was so you know what missteps to avoid at your next job. And most important, believe that there will be a next job. A lot of folks want to plan out their career step by step. First, I'm going to get a position at this company. Then I'm going to move on to a bigger place, they'll say. From there, I'm going to take an executive job. They've got their whole career from intern to manager to executive to CEO scripted out before they take their first step. It's great to have a vision for what you want to accomplish, but very rarely do people's blueprint for themselves go exactly according to plan. So please, never ever give up because things aren't going the way that you planned them at first. When I'm moving full steam toward my goals and suddenly I get knocked off my path, I don't get flustered or despondent. I just have the confidence that I'm going to be redirected to the next opportunity, which is why I like to call getting fired an act of divine misdirection. I've learned that I can map out all the moves I want, but ultimately, God's GPS is better than whatever navigation app I've downloaded. Leaving Z93 Jams. There was a growing buzz about my on-air presence, but I still couldn't land a full-time slot on Z93 Jams. It was a heritage station, one that has been running the same format for decades, which meant that it had more money, more promotion, more history, and a bigger signal than its competitors. Z93 Jams was and remains the big dog in the Charleston region. As a result, jocks rarely left because there was really no place better to go. I still had my internship in the promotions department and the occasional overnight shift, but I was hungry for more. I wanted to figure out a way to move up the ladder, so I started questioning all the full-time jocks about their journeys, looking for insights into what they'd done to get ahead. One thing I noticed was that they all had mass communication degrees. It occurred to me that my lack of a degree could be holding me back. To enhance my resume, I decided to enroll in a communications program at Trident Technical College in Charleston. It seemed like a good idea, but I didn't even make it through the first class. Why am I here, I asked myself, looking around at my fellow students. Most of them had barely set foot in the radio station, let alone hosted their own show like I had. I've been winning by following my instincts, I told myself. So why now should I listen to someone else's advice on the right way to do this? There was no good answer to that question, So I walked out of the class and never went back. I realized I was hustling backward at that school. I already had the privilege of working at a radio station. Instead of waiting for an instructor to tell me the right way to be on the air, I needed to exercise my privilege and figure it out on my own. I did learn one thing that day. No amount of classroom instruction can ever match the experience you'll get from actually performing a job. Nothing that is worth knowing can be taught. Oscar Wilde. Back at Jams, I settled into a groove of helping out with promotions and grabbing whatever air shifts I could. Around that time, there was a female listener named Jamaica who used to call into all the male jocks and talk real freaky to them. She had a very sexy voice, and people would always get a kick out of her calls. Then one day, I got hit up off the air by some folks who knew Jamaica and alerted me to the fact that she was actually a he. They even passed along her government name. The next time Jamaica called during one of my shifts, I confronted her and said, "Hey, Jamaica, isn't it true that your name is really such and such?" Jamaica wasn't happy about being outed and called up Jams to complain about me. She spoke to the program director, a guy named Terry Bass, and told me she was going to sue the station. Instead of telling Jamaica, "Hey, I don't see what Charlamagne did wrong," Terry overreacted and took away my shift, relegating me to Linus. For those of you who don't know the term, Linus means recording scripts for the time, weather, and introducing the next song. Technically, I was still on air, but I'd lost the platform to express my personality. Having to read off a script? That was the worst thing that could happen to me. I went from being impatient to downright miserable. But as has often been the case in my career, what seemed to be a dead end was actually God setting me up for my next winning move. A new station called Hot 98.9 was launched in Charleston to compete with Jams. It didn't have nearly the signal strength as Jams, but it was looking to make a splash in the market. They'd heard me on Jams and offered me my own nightly show, 7 to midnight, every Monday through Saturday. On paper, staying with Jams would have been the safe bet, even if it meant being stuck on Linus for a while. Jams still had the best reputation in the area, and chances were, eventually something would have opened up for me. Safe bets, however, have never appealed to me. I quietly agreed to a deal with Hot, which wasn't a betrayal because Jams had never committed to me full time. Few things I'd ever done at that point in my life had felt better than walking into Terry Bass's office and handing in my resignation letter. I didn't tell him why I was leaving, but he probably figured it out when Hot started running promos for my new show later that day. Some people at Jams said I was a fool for leaving, but I didn't give it a second thought. Besides being productive and improving my craft, I was also getting a real paycheck for the first time in my life. Granted, my salary was only 19 grand a year, but when your employment history includes Taco Bell and selling crack, just saying you have a salary makes you feel like the man. My program director at Hot was George Cook, who remains a friend and mentor to this day. Back then, George was just another young radio guy trying to figure things out on the fly. His idea was for me to host a nighttime show that had the feel of a morning show. George's reasoning was that since the late, great Doug Banks was syndicated on Hot in the mornings, it was important for the station to have a local show heavy on talk on at night. I loved the concept. Taking calls and talking to people was my passion because it was the best way to stay connected to the streets. Looking back, interacting with callers on the radio was one of the precursors to social media. And there's no doubt radio personalities are the original catfish. If I had a dollar for every time someone tells me, "Man, you don't look the way you sound." My signature segment was called Hate O'Clock. I would open up the phones and say, "Hot 98.9, holla if you're hating." And people would just vent about whatever was bothering them. Someone might hate on a shirt someone at their school was wearing. On 9/11, everyone called in hating on Bin Laden. They'd even call in and hate on me. I used to love it. Another feature I started was called Lyrical Warfare, which gave would-be rappers an opportunity to call up the station and spit a freestyle. If they were dope, I'd give them props. If they were whack, I'd play a sound effect that said, "You are babunky, babunky, babunky." People still quote that sound effect in Charleston to this day. I remember one guy called in who was doing way too much DMX-style grunting during his rap. When he was done, I told him it sounded like he was having rough gay sex with Hulk Hogan. I've always believed in the balance of ratchetness and righteousness. So around 11 p.m., I would wind things down with a segment called Charlamagne the God, Thug Love Status. I would play nothing but slow songs and talk directly to the ladies in the audience, making sure to end the show on a positive note. That balance was a hit, and within a couple of months, I took the show from number 14 to number 2 in the market. I was still living with my mama, but suddenly I was a bit of a celebrity in Charleston, which was a new experience to me. Yes, I had been popular in high school, but being well-known in an actual city on the radio, that was virgin territory, and I didn't know how to handle it. Messed up by fame. I won't even try to sugarcoat it. I let my newfound fame get to my head. And by fame, I'm not talking about making a lot of money, driving a fancy car, or appearing on TV. For a 20-something-year-old radio jock in South Carolina, fame was seeing your name on the marquee of a club for the first time. Or when you walk into a party, everybody acts like you're a celebrity instead of a radio personality making 19 grand a year. Pretty tame stuff, but that was more than enough to get me gassed. I didn't have much money, but I had the ability to make or break people socially, and I took advantage of that. One moment that illustrates how shitty my head was started at Nightlife, a club in Kings Creek, South Carolina, where I was hosting a party. My name was on the marquee in big letters, Charlemagne the God. There was already a line outside, and soon as I got out of the car, people mobbed me and started showing me love. I felt like a movie star, or a rapper with a hit single in heavy rotation. One of the people crowding around me was a beautiful young woman named Jubilee. One of my homeboys asked her, "What's up for the night?" And without blinking, she said, "I'm going to do whatever Charlemagne wants me to do." I'll never forget those words. We ended up taking this young lady back to Monk's Corner later that night. When I say she fucked the team, she fucked the team. She had sex with at least 6 of my homeboys. That was Saturday night. But we weren't done. That Monday night, I was doing an on-site broadcast from a club in Latson, South Carolina called The Diplomat. A local rap trio was hanging out there, and I told them, "I got this girl here. She'll give you head for $50. Jubilee was with it. I made $150 that night. Yes, it was all consensual, but I was behaving like a piece of shit. I'd gotten a taste of power and couldn't handle it. As the saying goes, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. My ratings on Hot 98.9 kept being strong, but trouble was headed my way. The station brought in a consultant named Michael Newman, who also consulted for Hot 97 in New York. At the time, the biggest hip-hop station in the country. Michael wasn't feeling my style and tried to give me some notes. In my heightened arrogance, instead of taking his advice, I told him, "Send my air check to someone who will get it. I know they'll love this on Hot 97 in New York." Michael wasn't with it, but I got George Cook to vouch for me, and Michael finally relented. He sent my air check to Hot's legendary PD, Tracy Cloherty, who proceeded to trash it. "Why is he screaming all the time?" was one of her notes. Michael had always thought I was too ghetto, so he used Tracy's reaction to take me down several notches. To my understanding, he recommended to George that I be fired from Hot 98.9 if I didn't change my ways. I caught wind of what he proposed and confronted him. "Some white dude from who knows where is not going to tell me how to talk to my people in Charleston," I told him. Of course, Michael really wanted me gone after that. He kept pushing George to let me go, and when he wouldn't, they decided to let George go instead. He was replaced by a DJ named Corey Hill. Corey was a popular radio personality, someone I had grown up listening to on the station 100.9. Despite my respect for his track record, Corey and I got off to a bad start. Corey was an incredible on-air talent, but that was the problem. He was a radio personality. I didn't want a fellow jock to be my boss, especially one I knew I was better than. One of Corey's first moves was to make me get rid of all the features, pre-produced bits or scripted segments in my show, the very elements that had made me so popular. That meant Hate O'Clock and Lyrical Warfare were all gone. It felt similar to when Terry put me on Liners at Jams. Without my features, I felt powerless. The job started to feel like work again instead of fun. Looking back, I can see I had been leaning on features too much. I hadn't learned how to trust my ability to carry a show on my own without any props. But Corey hadn't taken away my features to help me develop into a better on-air personality. He was really trying to get me the fuck out of there. Things came to a head quickly. I had gone to Miami one weekend and came back on Monday. Before my shift, Corey called me at home and told me, "Don't come into work until we talk." "Am I suspended?" I asked him. "What did I do?" "Oh, it's nothing," he replied. "Just wait to hear back from me." 3 days went by before Cliff Fletcher, the general manager of the station, called and asked me why I hadn't been coming into work. "Corey told me to stay home until he talked to me," I explained. This was news to Cliff. "Why didn't you call me when that happened?" he asked. "Now we need to talk." So Cliff and I went out to lunch. Well, he explained that he needed me and Corey to work things out. Cliff's research showed that the station's ratings spiked when I was on, but then would flatten out again after my shift. Cliff said this showed the station needed to build around my energy. After I said I'd try to work things out, Cliff went back to the station to see if Corey would agree to the truce. While Corey conceded that my show was popular, he said he still didn't think I was a good fit for the station. His big thing was that I was too out of control. When pressed for an example, he claimed I'd said, "Suck my big black dick on the air." I knew that wasn't true because A, I don't have a big dick. B, I don't believe in lying. And C, if I had talked about my dick, it would have been in a much wittier fashion than that. Despite all the accusations, Corey and I agreed to bury the hatchet, but then a week or so later, I got a voicemail from Corey saying the station had decided to move in another direction. There it was, my first firing. I'd barely been on the air for a year, and already I was out of the game. I've talked about the importance of not giving a fuck, but the truth is, I gave a huge fuck when I got that voicemail from Corey. I was getting canned from a job that I loved, a job that had become central to my identity. I felt I needed that job, especially coming from where I'd been. I was worried my radio career was over before it had ever really gotten started. There was even a DJ on Z93 Jams named DJ Kaz. I used to clown him and call him DJ Ass, who openly gloated at my demise. He and Corey were friends, and as soon as I got canned, he went on air and started sending subliminal shots my way saying, "Somebody just got fired in this town. Y'all know who it is. And you will probably never hear that guy on the radio again." After I got fired, I fell into the classic trap of blaming the haters for what had happened to me. "I know Corey Hill, Michael Newman, and DJ Kaz were behind this. They got me fired," I'd mutter to myself. And they probably were, but the situation was still clearly my fault. Once I calmed down and did some self-evaluation, I was able to see the lesson in my loss. I needed to humble myself. I'd abused the power and position that came from being a local celebrity. I was putting out terrible energy into the world, and true to the laws of karma, it didn't take long for that energy to return to me. I also learned another critical lesson from that situation. Never say I'm not ready when faced with an opportunity. When George Cook had been let go, Cliff Fletcher had asked if I'd have any interest in the PD job. I told him no, because I didn't think I could do it. Later, after I told Dr. Evans that I'd potentially passed on the job, he let me have it. "Why?" he asked incredulously. "Because I'm just starting in radio," I stuttered. "I don't know how to be no program director." "If I ever hear you say what you can't do again, I'll slap the shit out of you," he said before adding, "Listen to me, you son of a bitch. When there's an opportunity, you take it. You grab it now, and we'll figure out how to be a PD later. Never tell me or another person what you can't do. How do you even know you can't do it?" When he explained it to me like that, I knew he was speaking pure gospel. I wasn't the only person who learned from this situation. The station learned that when you have a hot radio personality, let that person cook instead of trying to dampen their flame. You see, after I was fired, over the next year, the station's numbers fell off so hard that the parent company eventually had to switch formats. When it was all said and done, nobody had a job. A pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. Winston Churchill. Despite so many missteps at the time, almost everyone involved eventually got themselves back on track. Today, George Cook is the director of operations and brand manager of K104 in Dallas, one of the most respected stations in the country. Corey Hill, who I'm happy to say is my guy now, is making moves as DJ Hustle Simmons, hosting shows in Boston and Myrtle Beach. DJ Kaz is still on Z93 Jams in Charleston. Roughly 15 years later, I think he finally got a full-time slot. No need to tell me I'm petty. I already know. Looking back, I can see that God had actually sent me a sign that getting fired from hot wasn't going to be more than a bump on my road to success. A friend of mine named Neek hosted middays at a station I worked at called Hot 103.9 in Columbia, South Carolina. She was also a God-fearing woman who would often go to the same church as me. Her faith supported me one day when I was wondering when I would get a call up to a bigger radio market. "Charlemagne, you just have to pay attention to signs," Neek told me. "God always shows you signs. In fact, when you leave this radio station today and drive home, the first license plate you see on another car might tell you exactly where you're going to wind up. It might sound crazy, but God will be planting a seed in your mind so you can fertilize it by constantly thinking about it and working toward it." Heading home later that day, Neek's words suddenly popped back into my head. So I looked at a truck passing me and saw the license plate read New Jersey. "There's no radio stations in New Jersey," I told myself, trying to downplay the moment. But then my mind immediately fired back. True, but that's only because everyone in New Jersey is listening to the New York radio stations. So I must be going to New York. As much as I wanted to have faith, I dismissed the idea. As a young radio personality in Columbia, it seemed inconceivable to ever land in the number one market in the country. It wasn't that I didn't believe in my talent, I did. It's just that I thought New York would be too hard to break into. I couldn't see it at the time because I wasn't properly recognizing the power of God in me. I wasn't cognizant of God's ability to make the impossible possible, as if taking a radio jock from Columbia, South Carolina to New York City was somehow above his pay grade. Man, that's light work for God. Remember, when God plants something in your spirit, embrace where that energy takes you. Don't make the mistake of fixating on what's not going to happen. Think about all that will happen, because you are following a plan laid out by the Creator. In my case, that divine direction would lead me 100 miles up the road to Columbia, South Carolina. The Big DM. After I was let go from Hot 98.9 in Charleston, I had no idea what to do with myself. There weren't many other options in the way of urban radio in Charleston. Thankfully, Dr. Evans came to my rescue with a game-changing suggestion. "You need to put together an album," he declared, after I shared my uncertainty with him. "What do you mean?" I asked. I had heard of DJs doing albums before, like DJ Clue, Funkmaster Flex, and Greg Street. What was the value in a jock doing an album, though? What I needed to do was get back on the air. Then Dr. Evans broke down his vision for me. Take some songs from never-so-deep artists and put a bunch of skits between them. Structure it like a radio show. Do talk breaks between the songs like you're on air. Give the skits all the energy that you had on the radio. That way, people won't forget about you. You'll be keeping the buzz you had on hot fresh in people's minds. I trusted Dr. Evans, so I got to work on what would ultimately be called Charlemagne the God Presents Concrete Champ, the radio show. The album featured 12 songs produced by Never So Deep, with short interviews and talk breaks I recorded in between each track. Just to give you an idea of how out there the album was, we had one skit where a girl tried to mix my cum with pancake batter. Yep, you heard that right. We pressed up 3,000 CDs of Concrete Champ and distributed them to record stores and radio stations all over South Carolina. Dr. Evans' instincts proved correct again. The album eventually made it into the hands of a brother named Mike Love, who was the PD of a station called the Big DM in Columbia, South Carolina. Mike liked what he heard so much that he offered me a job doing weekends at the station. Getting a job at the Big DM was a major blessing. Not only did it get me back on the air, but as an added bonus, Mook Mook was attending the University of South Carolina in Columbia at the time. Now I had a personal and professional reason to be in the city. Columbia was my first taste of working in a big city. If you're from Los Angeles or New York, you might take issue with that description, but trust me, Columbia was booming back then. I feel one of the reasons people sleep on Columbia is because they don't realize it is a college town. In addition to the University of South Carolina, it's also home to Benedict College and Allen University. Colleges mean there's plenty of young women. And where there are young women, there will also be plenty of young men looking to party. Plus, Columbia is only 3 or 4 hours away from Atlanta, so it was an easy destination for rappers, promoters, and hustlers looking to build their base outside of the ATL. The Big DM is where I met several future stars for the first time. One Saturday night, an unsigned rapper from Atlanta came by the station looking to play me his music. He had already put out one album, I'm Serious, on LaFace before getting dropped due to poor sales. Now he was out on the streets in Columbia trying to drum up support of his independent single, 24s. Of course, that rapper was T.I. When I first met T.I., he was rocking regular jeans and a dirty gray Champion hoodie. He might have looked fresh out the trap, but he still had all the aura of the megastar he is today. I played 24s on the air that night, and soon T.I. was a constant presence in the city, holding court in the clubs and screwing almost all our women, or so it seemed. Columbia became like a second home to T.I., as he later acknowledged in the DJ Khaled track We Taking Over, where he rapped, "Started in Atlanta, then I spread out with it, to South Carolina." When I heard that shout out, I was proud T.I. had remembered all the early love we gave him in Columbia. Another Atlanta rapper who paid his dues in Columbia was Young Jeezy. When Jeezy first showed up in Columbia looking to build a buzz, he wasn't signed to Def Jam yet. I remember my man Fats bought him to perform at a club called The Main Event with another artist from Atlanta named Big Country. Only 50 or 60 people showed up that night, but Jeezy still put on a high-energy show, which I respected. Jeezy didn't get discouraged and kept grinding, eventually dropping his classic mixtape Trap or Die. Then the world realized his talent. So when he played The Main Event a year later, over 3,000 people packed into the club, with another 1,000 on the street outside trying to get in. There is no artist from anywhere in that region, especially Atlanta, who didn't come through Columbia and build their buzz. Same with Killer Mike and 2 Chainz. Both those guys would spend a lot of time in Columbia doing performances before they broke nationally. Columbia was also the home of professional athletes like the NBA star Jermaine O'Neal and the NFL star Deuce Staley. There was a lot of energy in Columbia, and I fed off all of it. The drug game was absolutely booming in Columbia during that period, which meant there were lots of dealers who needed ways to clean their money. One of their favorite methods was throwing parties at the city's various clubs. They'd book the artists and hire me and one of my best friends to this day, DJ Frosty, to host the affairs. This was the height of the trap era, so as you can imagine, parties thrown by sovereign drug dealers tended to get crazy. One of the biggest issues was that cappers from the local colleges would show up to these parties wearing their traditional red colors and throwing up their hand signs, which pissed off the local Blood members who were also in the spot. The Bloods didn't understand the cappers were just a frat and thought they were trying to invade their turf. I saw a lot of stupid shit go down over that misunderstanding. On the air, I was really finding my groove. I'd bought back my Hate O'Clock segment and also introduced a new character called the Concrete Ghetto Chick, played by my good friend Ashley James. Columbia loved it, and our ratings were popping. It seemed I'd found a new home. Then radio politics tripped me up. Before switching to hip-hop, the Big DM had been an adult contemporary station. Despite the strong ratings my individual show was getting, the station's parent company, Inner City Broadcasting, decided that it wanted to switch back to adult contemporary. My segments had worked really well coming between clips of Ludacris records. That type of content wasn't going to fit too well between Earth, Wind & Fire or Eddie LaVert. Once the switch was announced, Mike Love kept it real with me and explained there wouldn't be a role for me at the new Big DM. But, he added, I should hold tight in Columbia because something else was cooking. In a few weeks, it came out that Inner City had bought Columbia's Hot 103.9, a hip-hop station that had previously been the Big DM's most heated local competitor. Just like that, my skill set was back in demand. I went from competing with Hot 103.9 in the ratings to being one of the new faces of their station. Bill Black, who worked at Hot 103.9 at the time, described it as similar to when the wrestler Bill Goldberg suddenly switched from the WCW to the WWE overnight. Personally, I wasn't too concerned with what station I was working on, as long as I was on the air and allowed to do my thing. And the new Hot 103.9 was definitely letting me cook. In the past, I had focused on features out of necessity. There simply weren't that many good interviews to be had. Once I was on Hot, that began to change. They became a power in the marketplace, and every established artist who came through town made sure to pay us a visit. My first interview to go viral, before going viral was a thing, was with Buffy the Body on Hot. If you don't remember Buffy, she was a video vixen who was infamous for being one of the first celebrities to get ass implants. I asked Buffy about what her plan would be when she got older, when her look started to fade and gravity set in. She didn't appreciate the question and ended up getting so mad that she threw a CD at me as she walked out of the studio. A lot of websites and blogs ran the interview, giving me my first taste of national exposure. In fact, my homeboy Van Lathan of TMZ recently told me that interview was what put me on his radar. He recalled that after Buffy told me to shut up because I was just a local radio personality in Columbia, I fired back that my mouth is going to take me farther than your butt. And if you check the scoreboard, I think most people would admit what I said has come to pass. It might have seemed like a bold prediction at the time, but I feel it's another example of how you can speak things into existence. Another memorable guest was a young Trey Songz, who I messed with by saying things like, listen, you're no Omarion. Even though it was one of Trey's first interviews, he didn't get flustered and laughed off my jokes. I always remember at the end of the interview, he told me that I had some of the same qualities as Starr and Buck Wild, who were ruling the airwaves in New York at the time. You need to be in New York too, he told me. Salutes to Trey for planting that seed in my head. My favorite interview from my time in Columbia was with Minister Louis Farrakhan. The minister had come to town to hold a press junket for the Millions More movement. At that time, I was doing youth ministry at Moss No. 38 in Columbia, so I was granted the privilege of attending the junket at a local hotel. Since I had grown up reading so much material from the Nation of Islam and watching Minister Farrakhan's videotapes, I was hyped to be in the same room with him. Too hyped, in fact. I was very aggressive and tried to turn the junket into my own personal conversation with the minister. As soon as they opened up the floor to questions, my hand shot up and I shouted out, Minister Farrakhan, can you give any advice on how to balance Islam and hip-hop? The minister gave a very thoughtful reply, and once he was finished, my hand shot up again. Minister Farrakhan, Can you speak about why we need socially redeeming value in music? He answered my question, and then my hand shot up one more time. Before I could shout out another question, Minister Farrakhan cut me off. Brother, you just wait, he said with a kind smile. I'm going to talk to you afterward. I figured he just said that to shut me up, but true to his word, one of his aides came up to me afterward and led me to a room where the minister was waiting. The minister patiently sat with me as I was able to ask him the rest of my questions. I was also able to present him with a document I'd written for Columbia's The State newspaper called The Ten Commandments of Hip Hop, which was my attempt to bring a little consciousness to the culture. When I was done, the minister sized me up and said, "Young man, I believe that you are more than what you appear to be to other people." That was a pivotal moment for me. Knowing that a wise elder like Minister Farrakhan saw my potential gave me immense confidence that I was on the right path. I ended up playing my interview with the minister on my show, which didn't sit well with everyone at the station. Chris Connors, who was my PD at HOT, pulled me aside and said, "Some people might not like the interview." He also hinted that those people also might not appreciate it when I wore my T-shirt with a picture of Minister Farrakhan around the station. I assumed he was talking about this fat-ass, redneck, white devil, boss hog-looking supervisor we had named Steve. "The hell with those people," I told him, and proudly continued to wear the shirt every chance I got. The Wendy Williams Experience. Inner City Broadcasting had been founded in 1970 as one of the first African-American-owned radio networks. The station's primary owners were the famed Harlem power broker Percy Sutton and Clarence Jones, who had published the Amsterdam News. Notable shareholders included future New York City Mayor David Dinkins, Malcolm X's widow Betty Shabazz, and Roberta Flack. Inner City made a splash in New York City with WBLS, an R&B station led by Frankie Crocker, one of the iconic DJs Dr. Evans had me study. During the late 70s and early 80s, the station became the number one black station in New York. Crocker was a true innovator, refusing to get boxed into the traditional limitations of black radio. He'd play records by rock acts like The Clash and Blondie, alongside new records from soul groups MSFB or Harold Melvin, giving zero fucks about what a black station was supposed to sound like. If a record had soul, he played it. That really resonated with me because these were the same acts that my father used to play at Zebra Club back in Monk's Corner. Like I said, if some British white boys like Queen had a funky song, the club was going to play it right alongside James Brown and George Clinton. Good music doesn't have a race. Unfortunately, Crocker got caught up in a payola scandal and was forced off the station, leaving black radio a lot less interesting. But WBLS continued to dominate, thanks to a new wave of hip-hop DJs like the legendary Mr. Magic and Marley Marl. By the mid-2000s, one of the biggest personalities on WBLS, alongside Steve Harvey, was Wendy Williams. Wendy had risen to stardom at New York's Hot 97 before she was fired, according to the rumors, for either insinuating that Diddy was gay or getting in a physical fight with fellow jock Angie Martinez, or maybe a combination of both. Regardless, after a successful stint at Power 99 in Philadelphia, Wendy made her triumphant return to NYC in 2001, after WBLS hired her to host afternoon drives. If you're interested in hearing more about her story, I recommend her autobiography, Wendy's Got the Heat. Since Inner City owned Hot 103.9, the company decided to syndicate her show in the afternoon in Columbia. It was a decision that didn't sit well with a lot of people locally. Our PD Chris Connors had been hosting a popular afternoon show that included the very popular 5 o'clock megamix. It felt like the suits in New York City were shitting on us when he ended up getting bounced from Wendy. Wendy was a big star nationally, but the listeners in Columbia raised hell and kept calling in and writing letters to demand Hot bring Chris's show back. Finally, Inner City gave in and put Chris back in his old slot, provided Hot would run Wendy's show at night from 10 to 2. That compromise unwittingly changed the course of my life. When Wendy's afternoon show got moved to nights, someone at Hot was supposed to make sure that that day's show was uploaded every evening at 10. Pretty simple, right? For whatever reason, that person was asleep at the wheel, and Hot just ended up playing the same show over and over again each night. When I heard the mistake, I decided to take it upon myself to call up Kevin Hunter, Wendy's husband and manager, who I'd previously met when he and Wendy had done a market visit in Columbia. I got Kevin on the phone and let him know what was going on with the audio. You might say this was another example of me snitching, but the truth is, I just assumed the screw-up was coming from Wendy's end. I figured the big stars in New York simply forgot to send the station in Columbia the right audio, and alerting them to it would just be a good way to get on their radar. Not to mention, as a fan, I wanted to hear what Wendy was up to. When Kevin found out about the situation, however, he was furious. Wendy's team had indeed been sending out the new audio every day, and Kevin suspected that the mix-up hadn't been a simple mistake. Instead, he decided that Chris Connors must have still been salty about having his show bumped and had made sure someone was intentionally sabotaging Wendy's broadcast. Kev was prepared to raise holy hell within the city, not that he ever needed much of an excuse, but decided first he needed to come to Columbia and check out the situation for himself. When he told me he was headed down, I once again created my own opportunity by offering to pick Kev up at the airport. Then I made it my business to show him around town for the weekend. I got him some weed, took him out to the best clubs, and did everything I could to show him the best the city had to offer. By the end of the weekend, Kev and I had developed a real friendship. Of course, Kev ended up screaming on the station after he was able to confirm they'd been running old shows, but he and I were good. Spending that weekend with Kevin would prove to be a pivotal moment in my life. At that point, I had been at Hot 103.9 for a few years. I started off doing just weekends, and then they teamed me up with Bill Black, a.k.a. Big Sexy, to host the Hot Boys show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. We did the show for about a year until Bill got a job in Atlanta. Today, he's operations manager at Radio 1 Cleveland. After which, I started hosting the show myself. Despite that success, here's the twist. The whole time I was at Hot, I was never a full-time employee. Even with a daily show, they were still paying me part-time money. So when Bill left and I was hosting the show myself, I figured Hot would finally make me a full-time employee. That meant a salary, benefits, vacations, and all that good shit. I figured wrong. Before I explain why, here's a second situation that also changed the course of my career. I swear I'm going to tie all of this together. Keep paying attention. There was a popular club in Columbia that would advertise on the station. An urban legend spread around town that one of the managers was drugging women and taking advantage of them. Then a young lady came forward to say that, yes, she had been drugged at the club. The cops did some investigating, and the manager ended up being arrested. His arrest didn't get much publicity, but the girl's cousin sent me a link to the Columbia Police Department's website. Being the public servant that I am, I posted the report on my personal MySpace and wrote a little caption suggesting maybe we shouldn't patronize this spot anymore. The club caught wind of my post and decided to sue both me and the radio station. I don't know why they bought Hot into it, seeing that I posted the info on my personal MySpace, not the radio station's website. The suit also claimed I defamed the manager by making the arrest public, but I only knew about it from the police website. Didn't that already make it public? Their lawsuit was all BS. Chris Connors, however, asked me to apologize to the club and the manager, which I flat out refused to do. I'm never going to apologize for speaking truth. Frankly, I was insulted that he'd even asked me. Suppose it had been your daughter, I demanded to know. Would you be upset at me posting his mugshot then? Chris replied that if it was his daughter, he would have kicked the dude's ass in the street. But he wouldn't have messed with the station's money by criticizing a sponsor. I understood where Chris was coming from, but I refused to budge. I wasn't apologizing. The station ended up settling the suit with the manager of the club for what I heard was only a measly $2,000. I didn't get off so cheaply. My punishment for criticizing a sponsor was seeing my 6 days a week schedule cut down to just Saturdays. Instead of getting put on full-time, I was barely holding on to my part-time status. Not long after I was demoted, Kevin called to check in on me. When he heard how my shifts had been cut back, he figured it might have had something to do with how he had raised hell during his visit. In his mind, his tantrum had hurt my standing at the station. I don't know if he was trying to make it up to me, but he told me to come to New York the following week for a party he and Wendy were hosting. A week later, I was up in NYC rubbing shoulders with one of my radio idols. Wendy had a couple of drinks in her and must have been feeling generous. "Charlamagne, why don't you sit in on my show tomorrow?" she asked. Now, I'm the kind of guy you can't say stuff like that to unless you really mean it. Wendy might have just said that to be nice, but you can best believe that the next morning I was blowing up Kev's phone. "Kev, Wendy told me I could come on today. What time should I be there?" When I didn't get a response, I refused to let the opportunity slip through my fingers. "Hey, Kev, it's Charlamagne again. What's the address? Let me know what's good." Kev finally got back to me with the info, and that afternoon, I got on the air with Wendy. Despite only being on the air with her for 25 minutes, I must have done pretty well, because that same night, Kev took me out to dinner and made me an unexpected offer. "Wendy is looking for a co-host, but she doesn't want a comedian," he told me. "She wants someone funny, but they should be edgy too, and preferably from the radio world. We think that person could be you." Then he added a caveat. "We can't pay you, but we can offer you a place to stay in Jersey for free while we figure things out to see if it works." The absence of a paycheck might have made a lot of people pause, but I didn't hesitate for a second. "I'm absolutely in," I replied. We shook on it, and by the following week, I was unofficially co-hosting one of the biggest radio shows in the country. Landing the spot on Wendy's show is a perfect example of why you should never get caught up worrying about what people might perceive as a loss. Before meeting Kev, I was a 20-something-year-old former crack dealer and convicted felon who had already been fired from radio once and was barely holding on by a thread to his current job. It might have looked like I was taking losses, but I refused to adopt the loser's mentality. A true winner values their integrity no matter what the fallout. If I had compromised my integrity and said sorry, maybe Chris Connors would have put me back on the air 5 days a week. Then maybe down the road he would have decided I was a good company man and given me a full-time position. I would have won security, but I would have lost so much more. If I had gone the safe route, I would have completely screwed up the route God had planned for me. That path might not have looked like a straight line of success, but like I said, God's always got the latest GPS update. I ended up co-hosting Wendy's show from February 2006 to November 2008. A period I consider both the best and worst time of my life. On the plus side, I did learn a hell of a lot about radio from Wendy. She taught me how to properly prep for a show, instead of solely relying on my ability to come in off the street and wing it. That approach had helped me make my mark in South Carolina, but I needed to be better prepared if I wanted to be successful on the national stage. Wendy was meticulously prepared every day, and I saw the value in doing research and having questions ready for every guest. Not just the big names or the people I was excited to talk to. She also taught me the importance of sharing my own experiences on air. You could talk about all the magazines and blogs you've read or discuss what rappers are dissing each other, but ultimately, sharing your own life is what will take you to the next level. Honesty and intimacy is what forges a real connection with the audience. If I had understood that in South Carolina, I wouldn't have been upset when Corey Hill took my features away. I would have still had my greatest asset, my own experiences. Wendy taught me so much, but sadly, we don't speak today. A couple of years back, when Elvis Duran, the man I call my radio godfather, brought me up during an interview with her, Wendy said, "Who?" The internet took that as proof that we were beefing, but ultimately, that isn't about anything that happened between us. It's about how Kev and I fell out over business. As for Wendy, she is the ultimate ride or die chick. I know she feels she has to have her husband's back, and I have to respect that. Even after I came on board as Wendy's co-host, I was still doing my Saturday night shift at Hot in Columbia. For a while, that worked out great. I would be with Wendy from Monday to Friday and then fly down to South Carolina for the weekend. I'd do my show, host a couple parties, make some bread, spend the night with Mook Mook, and then get back to New York by Monday morning. It was a great arrangement for me. It wasn't meant to last. The first shoe to drop was when Hot 103.9 took issue with me co-hosting Wendy's show. To this day, I've never quite understood that. If I was the program director of a station in South Carolina, I would be extremely excited about one of my weekend jocks co-hosting a nationally syndicated show during the week, especially if the jock was constantly shouting out the state and my station like I had been doing. But the fat-ass white devil, Boss Hog lookalike Steve, didn't see it that way. Chris Connors called me up one day and relayed that Steve had said, "Charlemagne can't have his cake and eat it too." Granted, Steve's fat ass would know about eating cake, and that the station needed to move in another direction. Just like that, I'd been fired for a second time. The other shoe was about to drop on Wendy's show. For the first year and a half, I was on a fantastic run. I was building up a fan base and advertisers that started requesting that I read their spots. When Wendy's contract got renewed in 2007, I was given a full-time salary of $70,000 a year. For someone whose sole income had been hosting parties in Columbia for $400 or $500 a pop, it felt like a windfall. Mook Mook had graduated from the University of South Carolina, so we settled into our own place in Jersey. In the summer of 2008, we welcomed our first daughter into the world. The future looked bright. Then in the fall of 2008, things got dark. The storm started when Nicole Spence, who was the show's talent booker, sued Wendy, Kev, and WBLS, claiming that Kev had sexually harassed her. In the suit which made all the papers, Nicole also claimed that she'd seen Kev physically assault Wendy at the station. I was named in the lawsuit, with Nicole claiming that she'd heard Kevin tell me that he wanted me to break Nicole's spirit. Wendy and Kev denied the charges, and for a while, it looked like both sides might settle. But ultimately, the lawsuit tore the show apart. Not only was the publicity damaging, but Wendy was spending more and more time on the TV show she'd landed at Fox. Reeling from bad press and fearing that her heart wasn't in radio anymore, the word around town was that Inner City was looking for a way to get out of their contract with Wendy. So on November 3rd, Dion Levinston, the GM at WBLS at the time, called me into his office and told me, you guessed it, we've decided to go in another direction. I wasn't the only one who got let go from Wendy's show that day. They also fired Nicole, executive producer Taryn Donatian, and production director Trev Hollywood. When the bloodbath was over, the only people left were basically Wendy and a board op. It was clear that if Wendy wasn't going to leave on her own, they would try to starve her out. Still, she took to the air the next day to say that things were still cool between the two of us. Charlemagne's gone. He's not forgotten, she told the audience. He is still part of La Familia. That is still my boy. He still sleeps in the purple room when he comes to the house. We still drink our Patron on Friday nights. I appreciated Wendy's public love and support, but the stakes were higher after this firing. I wasn't just worried about the impact it would have on my career. This time, I had a young daughter to think about. The day after I was fired from Wendy's show, Barack Obama became the first African-American to be elected president of the United States. Any disappointment I felt over the Wendy situation was temporarily overshadowed by the pride of seeing a black man headed to the White House. Once the excitement over President Obama's election had worn off, I had to confront the realities of being a father who could no longer provide for his family. Mook Mook and I had been living in Lyndhurst, New Jersey, where we'd put our daughter in daycare. Without my check from Wendy, that wasn't affordable any longer. I could have signed up for unemployment in NYC, but my pride just wouldn't let me do it. I was an able-bodied young man. The idea of taking a handout from the government just didn't sit right with me. Plus, I could only imagine what people would say if a picture leaked of me standing in line at the unemployment office. The jokes would never end. So I decided to keep my black ass home and watch our daughter while Mook Mook went to work every day for a blood lab in Manhattan. Now, for a lot of men, that situation would be the very definition of a loss. Going from a high-profile job to running a daddy daycare while his woman goes out and brings home the turkey bacon? Not me. I consider those days to be one of the highlights of my life. The reason is simple. It helped me build a lasting bond with my daughter. I'll be honest. I hadn't been off to the best start in the daddy department. Literally, the day after my daughter was born, I caught a flight to Minnesota, where I was presented with an award for being one of the top 30 under 30 in radio. It felt like a very big deal at the time. Alongside my guy, David Taz Daddy Anderson, I was one of only three black honorees that year. But in retrospect, it paled in comparison to being there for Mook Mook and our daughter after the delivery. Plus, when I did come back from Minnesota, things were starting to get very hectic around Wendy's show. My professional life was becoming a blur, and I wasn't home nearly as much as I should have been. If I hadn't been fired, I might have never embraced being a father the way I was forced to through staying home with my daughter. To this day, we're incredibly close, and I attribute that largely to the time I spent with her in Lyndhurst. I fed her, I read to her, I changed the diapers, took her for walks, put her down for naps. For 8 hours a day, I did everything for my daughter. This period in my life is a prime example of the principle that returning to your core doesn't always have to entail taking a physical trip. Very few things will center you and recharge your spirit like caring for your child. The best thing that happened to me was that instead of rushing into another radio job, I was able to press reset through staying at home with my daughter and get my mind and spirit together. In retrospect, getting fired from Wendy's show was exactly the misdirection God wanted for my personal development. Of course, providing for a child is tough when the funds aren't coming in, and we went through a period of what I would call light struggle. Even with me covering the childcare costs, it's still very difficult for a family to make it in Metro New York City on just one income, especially a worker at a blood center salary. After a few months, we fell behind on rent, and then the eviction notices started arriving. Since it was Mook Mook's name on the lease, she had to go to court and explain our situation to a judge. She's as prideful as I am, and it was very difficult for her to stand there and have to beg for a second chance. I hated seeing her in that position. Even still, I didn't ask anyone for help. I could have probably hit up Wendy and Kevin for a loan, but I was determined to make my own way out of the situation. I was convinced that everything would work out for one simple reason. I had done what I was supposed to do on Wendy's show. I'd been blessed with an opportunity in a major market, and I'd capitalized on it. I'd been funny. I'd been part of memorable interviews, and I'd built relationships with listeners. Yes, I'd been fired, but only because I'd gotten caught up in something that was larger than me. I wasn't fired because listeners thought I was boring or I was difficult to work with or even because I'd said something too controversial. I knew it wouldn't be a matter of if things worked out for me, but a matter of when. I was supremely confident, even in the face of unemployment, dirty diapers, and eviction notices, that I was going to be able to write my own ticket again. I just didn't know where it would take me. Philadelphia freedom. The answer came in the spring of 2009, when I was approached by Elroy Smith, Moshe Loren, and Johnny Glover about joining 100.3 The Beat in Philadelphia. The folks there liked what I'd done on Wendy's show. It turned out, they didn't even know that I'd had my own show in South Carolina and wanted to give me a shot. So in May of 2009, I launched Charlamagne Tha God in the Morning Beat. My show started off as stripped down as it could get. No producer, no co-host, no sidekick, just me and a board op. After a few weeks, I was allowed to hire a producer, so I reached out to my homie, Sasha Katie, who had been at WBLS with me. She was young, smart, and ambitious, and I was able to convince her to come work with me in Philly. I was still living in Lyndhurst at the time, and Sasha lived in the North Jersey city of Elizabeth, so every day we would drive back and forth to Philly. It was about 80 minutes each way, and we made that commute for several months. For that reason and that reason alone, I will always be grateful to Sasha and be there for her when she needs me. She'd later join me on The Breakfast Club as an associate producer, where she worked for 5 years before recently landing at Apple. The Beat might not have given me a lot of resources, but I connected almost immediately with the Philly audience. After a few months, I was ranked number 3 with 18 to 34-year-olds, which was the demographic the station was catering to. It helped that I had a few interviews break nationally. These were the days when the internet and social media were just coming into their own, and people would jump all over an interview that had some action in it. One was with Cassie, a singer who didn't have much of a voice, but had been given a recording contract, largely on the strength of her looks and the fact that she was dating Diddy. Cassie was a sweet girl who happened to come on my show during a very bad week for her. Her nude pics had just leaked, and she'd also delivered a terrible performance on BET's 106 in Park when that was the show that everyone watched. Being a man of the people, it was my duty to point these issues out. I had to tell her she was living in a Rihanna Beyoncé world and there would never be a spot in it for her. Trust me, it was a very entertaining interview. It's on YouTube right now for your listening pleasure. Philly is also where the Donkey of the Day feature was born. I had been calling people donkeys since Wendy's show after I heard 50 Cent say, "Look at these donkeys, bunch of fucking jackasses," on a G-Unit mixtape. There was something about how he said it that made me think it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. I started using the phrase, too, and by the time I got to Philly, I decided I needed to create a daily feature that gave folks the credit they deserved for being stupid. Donkey of the Day was born. Not everything I did on the air was ratchet. I did some righteous work, too. One day I received a call from Rashina Fennessy, the mother of a young girl named Asaya, who needed a liver transplant. Rashina felt she was getting the runaround from a hospital, so I let her come on and give the hospital's administration Donkey of the Day. It worked. Asaya got the transplant, and today she is a happy, healthy little girl. Sure, I could have gotten sued by that hospital, the same way I got sued by the nightclub back in Columbia, but I didn't care. I have no problem speaking up for what's right because I know that God will bless me for it in the long run. Philly was good to me, and I felt like I'd found a home. I was so confident Philly was going to be a long-term stop that Mook Mook and I decided the time was right to rent a townhouse in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is right across the Delaware River from Philly. The rent was more than we'd ever paid, but it would have cut my commute by more than half and allowed me to spend more time with the family. So it seemed like it would be money well spent. Then one morning, in October 2009, I woke up to find Twitter buzzing about a new Beanie Sigel song that dissed his former mentor, Jay-Z. Being that Beanie was from Philly, it seemed only right that I get him on the radio to explain himself. So I reached out to a mutual friend, and she arranged for Beanie to call into my show that very day. When I got Beanie on the air, he was very forthright about why he was upset with Jay. He claimed Jay distanced himself from the Philly rappers he signed to Rockefeller because they were Muslim and Jay's Jewish backers didn't like that affiliation. It was the type of conversation most radio hosts wouldn't touch without wearing surgical gloves. But being a man of the people, I felt I had no choice but to air the allegation if that's how Beanie felt. The interview went viral, and a reporter asked Jay-Z about what Beanie had told me that weekend. Jay responded with the quote, "Never has an artist done so much with so little," meaning that Beanie hadn't sold many albums in his career, but Jay had still managed to set him up with a clothing line, sneaker deal, and his own record label. As Jay saw it, he'd set his protege up to win, but Beanie, who'd had several run-ins with the law, just couldn't stay out of trouble long enough to take advantage of the opportunities. The Beanie interview originally aired on a Thursday, and I played it again during my shift on Friday. Thanks to Jay-Z's comments, it was also the top hip-hop story over that weekend, so of course we had to address it again during my show on Monday. I didn't anticipate any negative fallout, but after the shift was over, my program director, Boogie D, asked me to come into his office. I thought, if anything, he'd give me props for creating a national buzz, but instead, he chastised me for running the Beanie interview in the first place. "Why would you want to make an enemy out of Jay?" he asked. "I'm not trying to make an enemy out of anyone," I explained. "I'm just trying to put good content on the air." Obviously, there was no right answer for me to give, so he got to the point. "Sorry, but we're moving in another direction. We're going to have to let you go." For those keeping score at home, that's Radio Industry 4, Charlamagne 0. I can't lie. The Philly firing caught me off guard. But as soon as those all-too-familiar words were out of Boogie's lips, I was already mentally moving on. I didn't argue the decision or beg for my job. Instead, I told Boogie, "Thank you for the opportunity," and walked with him to my office, where he had to make sure I didn't grab anything valuable on my way out. He had nothing to worry about. I just picked up my Wayne Dyer Power of Intention cards and headed toward the door. "You ain't got anything else in here?" Boogie asked. "Nope," I replied, because I'm always prepared for situations like this. That remains a tradition of mine. I don't keep any personal items in my office because you just never know. As soon as I was out of the station, I jumped on Twitter to tell my audience what had gone down. "I just got fired from 100.3 to Beat in Philly," I tweeted. "Salute to Philly. I hope you all enjoyed me the past 6 months." I made the announcement myself because I didn't have anything to be ashamed of. I truly did not give a shit about getting fired because I knew I had done everything I was supposed to do while I was in Philly. I'd created great content, I'd used my platform to help people, and I'd conducted engaging interviews and asked the tough questions that it was my job to ask, no matter what the politics were. Whatever the reason they wanted to let me go, I knew it was only a temporary setback. The internet, however, wasn't ready to let things go so easily. Almost immediately, rumors began flying that I'd been canned because my interview with Beanie had pissed off Jay-Z. "Did Jay-Z have Charlamagne Tha God fired?" asked the headline from XXL.com. While the YBF.com claimed, "Source confirms Charlamagne fired over Beanie Siegel interview." The story created so much buzz that I started trending on Twitter for the first time in my career. I might have been fired, but I was infamous. To this day, I still don't know if Jay was behind the move. Recently, New York Magazine ran a profile on me that mentioned the rumor. Jay read the story and then texted me to ask, "Yo, did I really get you fired?" I don't think he was playing dumb. I've always found Jay to be one of the most down-to-earth and forthright dudes in the industry. If he had decided he wanted me fired, he would have let me know. I suspect it was a situation where Jay didn't push for it himself. Maybe someone on his label made a comment and the station ran with it. Or perhaps the station was moving proactively because they were worried about getting on Jay's bad side. No matter what really happened, I'm more than happy to have the greatest rapper alive got me fired on my resume. Having people think, rightly or wrongly, that your interview made Jay-Z pick up the phone is not a loss. Plus,